1939 to 1945. The Letter. Léoz Szilard, a charming and slightly eccentric Hungarian physicist, was an old friend of Einstein's. While living in Berlin in the 1920s, they had collaborated on the development of a new type of refrigerator, which they patented, but were unable to market successfully. After Szilard fled the Nazis, he made his way to England and then New York, where he worked at Columbia University on ways to create a nuclear chain reaction, an idea he had conceived while waiting at a stoplight in London a few years earlier. When he heard of the discovery of fission using uranium, Szilard realized that element might be used to produce this potentially explosive chain reaction. Szilard discussed this possibility with his close friend Eugene Wigner, another refugee physicist from Budapest, and they began to worry that the Germans might try to buy up the uranium supplies of the Congo, which was then a colony of Belgium. But how, they asked themselves, could two Hungarian refugees in America find a way to warn the Belgians? Then Szilard recalled that Einstein happened to be friends with that country's Queen Mother. Einstein was spending the summer of 1939 in a rented cottage on the North Fork of Eastern Long Island, across the great Peconic Bay from the villages of the Hamptons. There he sailed his small boat, Tinnef, bought sandals from the local department store, and played Bach with the store's owner. "We knew that Einstein was somewhere on Long Island, but we didn't know precisely where," Szilard recalled. So he phoned Einstein's Princeton office and was told he was renting the house of a Dr. Moore in the village of Peconic. On Sunday, July 16, 1939, they embarked on their mission with Wigner at the wheel. Szilard, like Einstein, did not drive. But when they arrived, they couldn't find the house, and nobody seemed to know who Dr. Moore was. Just as they were ready to give up, Szilard saw a young boy standing by the curb. "Do you by any chance know where Professor Einstein lives?" Like most people in the town, even those who had no idea who Dr. Moore was, the boy did, and he led them up to a cottage near the end of Old Grove Road, where they found Einstein lost in thought. Sitting at a bare wooden table on the screen porch of the sparsely furnished cottage, Szilard explained the process of how an explosive chain reaction could be produced in uranium layered with graphite by the neutrons released from nuclear fission. "I never thought of that," Einstein interjected. He asked a few questions, went over the process for 15 minutes, and then quickly grasped the implications. Instead of writing to the Queen Mother, Einstein suggested, perhaps they should write to a Belgian minister he knew. Wigner, showing some sensible propriety, suggested that perhaps three refugees should not be writing to a foreign government about secret security matters without consulting the State Department. In which case, they decided, perhaps the proper channel was a letter from Einstein, the only one of them famous enough to be heeded, to the Belgian ambassador, with a cover letter to the State Department. With that tentative plan in mind, Einstein dictated a draft in German. Wigner translated it, gave it to his secretary to be typed, and then sent it to Szilard. A few days later, a friend arranged for Szilard to talk to Alexander Sachs, an economist at Lehman Brothers and a friend of President Roosevelt. Showing a bit more savvy than the three theoretical physicists, Sachs insisted that the letter should go right to the White House, and he offered to hand-deliver it. It was the first time Szilard had met Sachs, but his bold plan was appealing. "It could not do any harm to try this way," he wrote Einstein. Should they talk by phone or meet in person to revise the letter? Einstein replied that he should come back out to Peconic. By that time, Wigner had gone to California for a visit. So Szilard enlisted, as driver and scientific sidekick, another friend from the amazing group of Hungarian refugees who were theoretical physicists, Edward Teller. "I believe his advice is valuable, but also I think you might enjoy getting to know him," Szilard told Einstein. "He is particularly nice." Another plus was that Teller had a big 1935 Plymouth. So, once again, Szilard headed out to Peconic. Szilard brought with him the original draft from 2 weeks earlier, but Einstein realized that they were now planning a letter that was far more momentous than one asking Belgian ministers to be careful about Congolese uranium exports. The world's most famous scientist was about to tell the President of the United States that he should begin contemplating a weapon of almost unimaginable impact that could unleash the power of the atom. Einstein dictated a letter in German, Szilard recalled, which Teller took down, and I used this German text as a guide in preparing two drafts of a letter to the president. According to Teller's notes, Einstein's dictated draft not only raised the question of Congo's uranium, but also explained the possibility of chain reactions, suggested that a new type of bomb could result, and urged the president to set up formal contact with physicists working on this topic. Szilard then prepared and sent back to Einstein a 45-line version and a 25-line one, both dated August 2, 1939, and left it up to Einstein to choose which he liked best. Einstein signed them both in a small scrawl, rather than with the flourish he sometimes used. The longer version, which is the one that eventually reached Roosevelt, read in part, "Sir, some recent work by E. Fermi and L. Szilard, which has been communicated to me in a manuscript, leads me to expect that the element uranium may be turned into a new and important source of energy in the immediate future. Certain aspects of this situation which has arisen seem to call for watchfulness, and, if necessary, quick action on the part of the administration. I believe, therefore, that it is my duty to bring to your attention the following facts and recommendations. It may become possible to set up a nuclear chain reaction in a large mass of uranium, by which vast amounts of power and large quantities of new radium-like elements would be generated. Now it appears almost certain that this could be achieved in the immediate future. This new phenomena would also lead to the construction of bombs, and it is conceivable, though much less certain, that extremely powerful bombs of a new type may thus be constructed. A single bomb of this type, carried by boat and exploded in a port, might very well destroy the whole port together with some of the surrounding territory. In view of this situation, you may think it desirable to have some permanent contact maintained between the administration and the group of physicists working on chain reactions in America." It ended with a warning that German scientists might be pursuing a bomb. Once the letter had been written and signed, they still had to figure out who could best get it into the hands of President Roosevelt. Einstein was unsure about Sachs. They considered instead financier Bernard Baruch and MIT President Carl Compton. More amazingly, when Szilard sent back the typed version of the letter, he suggested that they use as their intermediary Charles Lindbergh, whose solo transatlantic flight 12 years earlier had made him a celebrity. All three of the refugee Jews were apparently unaware that the aviator had been spending time in Germany, was decorated the year before by the Nazi Hermann Göring with that nation's Medal of Honor, and was becoming an isolationist and Roosevelt antagonist. Einstein had briefly met Lindbergh a few years earlier in New York, so he wrote a note of introduction, which he included when he returned the signed letters to Szilard. "I would like to ask you to do me a favor of receiving my friend Dr. Szilard and think very carefully about what he will tell you," Einstein wrote to Lindbergh. "To one who is outside of science, the matter he will bring up may seem fantastic. However, you will certainly become convinced that a possibility is presented here which has to be very carefully watched in the public interest." Lindbergh did not respond. So Szilard wrote him a reminder letter on September 13th, again asking for a meeting. 2 days later, they realized how clueless they had been when Lindbergh gave a nationwide radio address. It was a clarion call for isolationism. "The destiny of this country does not call for our involvement in European wars," Lindbergh began. Interwoven were hints of Lindbergh's pro-German sympathies and even some anti-Semitic implications about Jewish ownership of the media. "We must ask who owns and influences the newspaper, the news picture, and the radio station," he said. "If our people know the truth, our country is not likely to enter the war." Szilard's next letter to Einstein stated the obvious. Lindbergh is not our man. Their other hope was Alexander Sachs, who had been given the formal letter to Roosevelt that Einstein signed. Even though it was obviously of enormous importance, Sachs was not able to find the opportunity to deliver it for almost 2 months. By then, events had turned what was an important letter into an urgent one. At the end of August 1939, the Nazis and Soviets stunned the world by signing their War Alliance Pact and proceeded to carve up Poland. That prompted Britain and France to declare war, starting the century's Second World War. For the time being, America stayed neutral, or at least did not declare war. The country did, however, begin to rearm and to develop whatever new weapons might be necessary for its future involvement. Szilard went to see Sachs in late September and was horrified to discover that he still had not been able to schedule an appointment with Roosevelt. "There is a distinct possibility Sachs will be of no use to us," Szilard wrote Einstein. "Wigner and I have decided to accord him 10 days' grace." Sachs barely made the deadline. On the afternoon of Wednesday, October 11th, he was ushered into the Oval Office carrying Einstein's letter, Szilard's memo, and an 800-word summary he had written on his own. The president greeted him jovially. "Alex, what are you up to?" Sachs could be loquacious, which may be why the president's handlers made it hard for him to get an appointment, and he tended to tell the president parables. This time it was a tale about an inventor who told Napoleon that he would build him a new type of ship that could travel using steam rather than sails. Napoleon dismissed him as crazy. Sachs then revealed that the visitor was Robert Fulton, and so went the lesson. The emperor should have listened. Roosevelt responded by scribbling a note to an aide, who hurried off and soon returned with a bottle of very old and rare Napoleon brandy that Roosevelt said had been in his family for a while. He poured 2 glasses. Sachs worried that if he left the memos and papers with Roosevelt, they might be glanced at and then pushed aside. The only reliable way to deliver them, he decided, was to read them aloud. Standing in front of the president's desk, he read his summation of Einstein's letter, parts of Szilard's memo, and some other paragraphs from assorted historical documents. "Alex, what you are after is to see that the Nazis don't blow us up," the president said. "Precisely," Sachs replied. Roosevelt called in his personal assistant. "This requires action," he declared. That evening, plans were drawn up for an ad hoc committee coordinated by Dr. Lyman Briggs, director of the Bureau of Standards, the nation's physics laboratory. It met informally for the first time in Washington on October 21st. Einstein was not there, nor did he want to be. He was neither a nuclear physicist nor someone who enjoyed proximity to political or military leaders. But his Hungarian émigré trio, Szilard, Wigner, and Teller, were there to launch the effort. The following week, Einstein received a polite and formal thank-you letter from the president. "I have convened a board," Roosevelt wrote, "to thoroughly investigate the possibilities of your suggestion regarding the element of uranium." Work on the atomic project proceeded slowly. Over the next few months, the Roosevelt administration approved only $6,000 for graphite and uranium experiments. Szilard became impatient. He was becoming more convinced of the feasibility of chain reaction and more worried about reports he was getting from fellow refugees on the activity in Germany. So in March 1940, he went to Princeton to see Einstein again. They composed another letter for Einstein to sign, which was addressed to Alexander Sachs but intended for him to convey to the president. It warned of all the work on uranium they heard was being done in Berlin. Given the progress being made in producing chain reactions with huge explosive potential, the letter urged the president to consider whether the American work was proceeding quickly enough. Roosevelt reacted by calling for a conference designed to spur greater urgency, and he told officials to make sure that Einstein could attend. But Einstein had no desire to be more involved. He replied by saying he had a cold, somewhat of a convenient excuse, and did not need to be at the meeting. But he did urge the group to get moving. "I am convinced of the wisdom and urgency of creating the conditions under which work can be carried out with greater speed and on a larger scale." Even if Einstein had wanted to take part in the meetings, which led to the Manhattan Project that developed the atom bomb, he may not have been welcome. Amazingly, the man who had helped get the project launched was considered by some to be too great a potential security risk to be permitted to know about the work. Brigadier General Sherman Miles, the acting Army Chief of Staff who was organizing the new committee, sent a letter in July 1940 to J. Edgar Hoover, who had already been the director of the FBI for 16 years and would remain so for another 32. By addressing him by his National Guard rank as Colonel Hoover, the general was subtly pulling rank when it came to controlling intelligence decisions. But Hoover was assertive when Miles asked for a summary of information the Bureau had on Einstein. Hoover began by providing General Miles with the letter from Mrs. Frothingham's Woman Patriot Corporation, which had argued in 1932 that Einstein should be denied a visa and raised alarms about various pacifist and political groups he had supported. The Bureau made no attempt to verify or assess any of the charges. Hoover went on to say that Einstein had been involved in the World Anti-War Congress in Amsterdam in 1932, which had some European communists on its committee. This was the conference that Einstein, as noted earlier, had specifically and publicly declined to attend or even support. As he wrote the organizer, "Because of the glorification of Soviet Russia it includes, I cannot bring myself to sign it." Einstein had gone on in that letter to denounce Russia, where there seems to be complete suppression of the individual and of freedom of speech. Nevertheless, Hoover implied that Einstein had supported the conference and was thus pro-Soviet. Hoover's letter had six more paragraphs making similar allegations about a variety of alleged Einstein associations, ranging from pacifist groups to those supporting Spain's loyalists. Appended was a biographical sketch filled with trivial misinformation, has one child, and wild allegations. It called him an extreme radical, which he certainly was not, and said he has contributed to communist magazines, which he hadn't. General Miles was so taken aback by the memo that he wrote a note in the margin warning, "There is some possibility of flameback, if it ever leaked." The conclusion of the unsigned biographical sketch was stark. In view of this radical background, this office would not recommend the employment of Dr. Einstein on matters of a secret nature, without a very careful investigation, as it seems unlikely that a man of his background could, in such a short time, become a loyal American citizen. In a memo the following year, it was reported that the Navy had assented to giving Einstein a security clearance, but the Army could not clear. Citizen Einstein. Just as the Army's decision was being made, Einstein was in fact eagerly doing something the likes of which he had not done for 40 years, ever since he had saved up his money so he could become a Swiss citizen after leaving Germany. He was voluntarily and proudly becoming a citizen of the United States, a process that had begun 5 years earlier when he sailed to Bermuda so that he could return on an immigration visa. He still had his Swiss citizenship and passport, so he did not need to do this, but he wanted to. He took his citizenship test on June 22, 1940, in front of a federal judge in Trenton. To celebrate the process, he agreed to give a radio interview as part of the Immigration Service's I Am an American series. The judge served lunch and had the radio folks set up in his chambers to make the process easier for Einstein. It was an inspiring day, partly because Einstein showed just what type of free-speaking citizen he would be. In his radio talk, he argued that to prevent wars in the future, nations would have to give up some of their sovereignty to an armed international federation of nations. A worldwide organization cannot ensure peace effectively unless it has control over the entire military power of its members, he said. Einstein passed his test, and he was sworn in, along with his stepdaughter Margot, his assistant Helen Dukas, and 86 other new citizens, on October 1st. Afterward, he praised America to the reporters covering his naturalization. The nation, he said, would prove that democracy is not just a form of government, but a way of life tied to a great tradition, the tradition of moral strength. Asked if he would renounce other loyalties, he joyously declared that he would even renounce my cherished sailboat if that were necessary. It was not, however, necessary for him to renounce his Swiss citizenship, and he did not. When he first arrived in Princeton, Einstein had been impressed that America was, or could be, a land free of the rigid class hierarchies and servility in Europe. But what grew to impress him more, and what made him fundamentally such a good American, but also a controversial one, was the country's tolerance of free thought, free speech, and nonconformist beliefs. That had been a touchstone of his science, and now it was a touchstone of his citizenship. He had forsaken Nazi Germany with the public pronouncement that he would not live in a country where people were denied the freedom to hold and express their own thoughts. "At that time, I did not understand how right I was in my choice of America as such a place," he wrote in an unpublished essay just after becoming a citizen. "On every side I hear men and women expressing their opinion on candidates for office and the issues of the day without fear of consequences." The beauty of America, he said, was that this tolerance of each person's ideas existed without the brute force and fear that had arisen in Europe. "From what I have seen of Americans, I think that life would not be worth living to them without this freedom of self-expression." The depth of his appreciation for America's core value would help explain Einstein's cold public anger and dissent when, during the McCarthy era a few years later, the nation lapsed into a period marked by the intimidation of those with unpopular views. More than 2 years after Einstein and his colleagues had urged attention to the possibility of building atomic weapons, the United States launched the super-secret Manhattan Project. It happened on December 6, 1941, which turned out to be, fittingly enough, the day before Japan launched its attack on Pearl Harbor that brought the nation into the war. Because so many fellow physicists such as Wigner, Szilard, Oppenheimer, and Teller had disappeared to obscure towns, Einstein was able to surmise that the bomb-making work he had recommended was now proceeding with greater urgency. But he was not asked to join the Manhattan Project, nor was he officially told about it. There were many reasons he was not secretly summoned to places like Los Alamos or Oak Ridge. He was not a nuclear physicist, or a practicing expert in the scientific issues at hand. He was, as noted, considered by some a security risk. And even though he had put aside his pacifist sentiments, he never expressed any desire or made any requests to enlist in the endeavor. He was, however, offered a bit part that December. Vannevar Bush, the director of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, which oversaw the Manhattan Project, contacted Einstein through the man who had succeeded Flexner as the head of the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton, Frank Adelot, and asked for his help on a problem involving the separation of isotopes that shared chemical traits. Einstein was happy to comply. Drawing on his old expertise in osmosis and diffusion, he worked on a process of gaseous diffusion in which uranium was converted into a gas and forced through filters. To preserve secrecy, he was not even allowed to have Helen Dukas or anyone else type up his work, so he sent it back in his careful handwriting. "Einstein was very much interested in your problem, has worked on it for a couple of days, and produced the solution, which I enclosed," Adelot wrote Bush. "Einstein asks me to say that if there are other angles of the problem that you want him to develop, or if you wish any parts of this amplified, you need only let him know, and he will do anything in his power. I very much hope that you will make use of him in any way that occurs to you, because I know how deep is his satisfaction at doing anything which might be useful in the national effort." As an afterthought, Adelot added, "I hope you can read his handwriting." The scientists who received Einstein's paper were impressed, and they discussed it with Vannevar Bush. But in order for Einstein to be more useful, they said, he should be given more information about how the isotope separation fit in with other parts of the bomb-making challenge. Bush refused. He knew that Einstein would have trouble getting a security clearance. "I do not feel that I ought to take him into confidence on the subject to the extent of showing just where this thing fits into the defense picture," Bush wrote Adelot. "I very much wish that I could place the whole thing before him and take him fully into confidence, but this is utterly impossible in view of the attitude of people here in Washington who have studied his whole history." Later during the war, Einstein helped with less secret matters. A Navy lieutenant came to visit him at the Institute to enlist him in analyzing ordnance capabilities. He was enthusiastic. As Adelot noted, he had felt neglected since his brief flurry of work on uranium isotopes. Among the issues Einstein explored as part of a $25 per day consulting arrangement were ways to shape the placement of sea mines in Japanese harbors. And his friend, the physicist George Gamow, got to come pick his brain on a variety of topics. "I am in the Navy," but not required to get a Navy haircut, Einstein joked to colleagues, who probably had trouble picturing him with a crew cut. Einstein also helped the war effort by donating a manuscript of his special relativity paper to be auctioned off for a war bond drive. It was not the original version. He had thrown that away back when it was published in 1905, not knowing it would ever be worth millions. To recreate the manuscript, he had Helen Dukas read the paper to him aloud as he copied down the words. "Did I really say it that way?" he griped at one point. When Dukas assured him that he had, Einstein lamented, "I could have put it much more simply." When he heard that the manuscript, along with one other, had sold for $11.5 million, he declared that economists will have to revise their theories of value. Atomic fears. The physicist Otto Stern, who had been one of Einstein's friends since their days together in Prague, had been secretly working on the Manhattan Project, mainly in Chicago, and had a good sense by the end of 1944 that it would be successful. That December he came to visit Princeton. What Einstein heard upset him. Whether or not the bomb was used in the war, it would change the nature of both war and peace forever. The policymakers weren't thinking about that, he and Stern agreed, and they must be encouraged to do so before it was too late. So Einstein decided to write to Niels Bohr. They had sparred over quantum mechanics, but Einstein trusted his judgment on more earthly issues. Einstein was one of the few people to know that Bohr, who was half-Jewish, was secretly in the United States. When the Nazis overran Denmark, he had made a daring escape by sailing with his son in a small boat to Sweden. From there he had been flown to Britain, given a fake passport with the name John Baker, then sent to America to join the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos. Einstein wrote to Bohr using his real name, care of Denmark's embassy in Washington, and somehow the letter got to him. In it, Einstein described his worrisome talk with Stern about the dearth of thinking about how to control atomic weapons in the future. The politicians do not appreciate the possibilities, and consequently do not know the extent of the menace, Einstein wrote. Once again, he made his argument that it would take an empowered world government to prevent an arms race once the age of atomic weaponry arrived. Scientists, who know how to get a hearing with political leaders, Einstein urged, should bring pressure on the political leaders in their countries in order to bring about an internationalization of military power. Thus began what would be the political mission that would dominate the remaining decade of Einstein's life. Since his days as a teenager in Germany, he had been repulsed by nationalism, and he had long argued that the best way to prevent wars was to create a world authority that had the right to resolve disputes and the military power to impose its resolutions. Now, with the impending advent of a weapon so awesome that it could transform both war and peace, Einstein viewed this approach as no longer an ideal, but a necessity. Bohr was unnerved by Einstein's letter, but not for the reason Einstein would have hoped. The Dane shared his desire for the internationalization of atomic weaponry, and he had advocated that approach in meetings with Churchill and then with Roosevelt earlier in the year. But instead of persuading them, he had prompted the two leaders to issue a joint order to their intelligence agencies, saying that inquiries should be made regarding the activities of Professor Bohr and steps taken to ensure that he is responsible for no leakage of information, particularly to the Russians. So upon receiving Einstein's letter, Bohr hurried to Princeton. He wanted to protect his friend by warning him to be circumspect, and he also hoped to repair his own reputation by reporting to government officials on what Einstein said. During their private talk at the Mercer Street house, Bohr told Einstein that there would be the most deplorable consequences if anyone who knew about the development of the bomb shared that information. Responsible statesmen in Washington and London, Bohr assured him, were aware of the threat caused by the bomb, as well as the unique opportunity for furthering a harmonious relationship between nations. Einstein was persuaded. He promised that he would refrain from sharing any information he had surmised and would urge his friends not to do anything to complicate American or British foreign policy. And he immediately set out to make good on his word by writing a letter to Stern that was, for Einstein, remarkable in its circumspection. I have the impression that one must strive seriously to be responsible, that one does best not to speak about the matter for the time being, and that it would in no way help at the present moment to bring it to public notice, he said. He was careful not to reveal anything, even that he had met with Bohr. It is difficult for me to speak in such a nebulous way, but for the moment I cannot do anything else. Einstein's only intervention before the end of the war was prompted again by Szilard, who came to visit in March 1945 and expressed anxiety about how the bomb might be used. It was clear that Germany, now weeks away from defeat, was not making a bomb. So why should the Americans rush to complete one? And shouldn't policymakers think twice about using it against Japan when it might not be needed to secure victory? Einstein agreed to write another letter to President Roosevelt, urging him to meet with Szilard and other concerned scientists, but he went out of his way to feign ignorance. I do not know the substance of the considerations and recommendations which Dr. Szilard proposes to submit to you, Einstein wrote. The terms of secrecy, under which Dr. Szilard is working at present, do not permit him to give me information about his work. However, I understand that he now is greatly concerned about the lack of adequate contact between scientists who are doing this work and those members of your cabinet who are responsible for formulating policy. Roosevelt never read the letter. It was found in his office after he died on April 12th, and was passed on to Harry Truman, who in turn gave it to his designated Secretary of State, James Burns. The result was a meeting between Szilard and Burns in South Carolina, but Burns was neither moved nor impressed. The atom bomb was dropped, with little high-level debate, on August 6, 1945, on the city of Hiroshima. Einstein was at the cottage he rented that summer on Saranac Lake in the Adirondacks, taking an afternoon nap. Helen Dukas informed him when he came down for tea. "Oh, my God," is all he said. 3 days later, the bomb was used again, this time on Nagasaki. The following day, officials in Washington released a long history, compiled by Princeton physics professor Henry DeWolf Smythe, of the secret endeavor to build the weapon. The Smythe report, much to Einstein's lasting discomfort, assigned great historic weight for the launch of the project to the 1939 letter he had written to Roosevelt. Between the influence imputed to that letter and the underlying relationship between energy and mass that he had formulated 40 years earlier, Einstein became associated in the popular imagination with the making of the atom bomb, even though his involvement was marginal. Time put him on its cover with a portrait showing a mushroom cloud erupting behind him with E equals MC squared emblazoned on it. In a story that was overseen by an editor named Whitaker Chambers, the magazine noted with its typical prose flair from the period, "Through the incomparable blast and flame that will follow, there will be dimly discernible, to those who are interested in cause and effect in history, the features of a shy, almost saintly, childlike little man, with the soft brown eyes, the drooping facial lines of a world-weary hound, and hair like an aurora borealis. Albert Einstein did not work directly on the atom bomb. But Einstein was the father of the bomb in two important ways. One, it was his initiative, which started U.S. bomb research. Two, it was his equation, E equals MC squared, which made the atomic bomb theoretically possible." It was a perception that plagued him. When Newsweek did a cover on him with the headline, "The Man Who Started It All," Einstein offered a memorable lament. "Had I known that the Germans would not succeed in producing an atomic bomb," he said, "I never would have lifted a finger." Of course, neither he, nor Szilard, nor any of their friends involved with the bomb-building effort, many of them refugees from Hitler's horrors, could know that the brilliant scientists they had left behind in Berlin, such as Heisenberg, would fail to unlock the secrets. "Perhaps I can be forgiven," Einstein said a few months before his death in a conversation with Linus Pauling, "because we all felt that there was a high probability that the Germans were working on this problem, and they might succeed and use the atomic bomb and become the master race." Chapter 22. One Worlder. 1945 to 1948. Arms Control. For a few weeks after the dropping of the atom bomb, Einstein was uncharacteristically reticent. He fended off reporters who were knocking at his door in Saranac Lake, and he even declined to give a quote to his summer neighbor, Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, publisher of the New York Times, when he called. It was only as he was about to leave his summer rental in mid-September, more than a month after the bombs had been dropped, that Einstein agreed to discuss the issue with a wire service reporter who came calling. The point he stressed was that the bomb reinforced his longtime support for world federalism. The only salvation for civilization and the human race lies in the creation of world government, he said. As long as sovereign states continue to have armaments and armament secrets, new world wars will be inevitable. As in science, so it was in world politics for Einstein. He sought a unified set of principles that could create order out of anarchy. A system based on sovereign nations with their own military forces, competing ideologies, and conflicting national interests would inevitably produce more wars. So he regarded a world authority as realistic rather than idealistic, as practical rather than naive. He had been circumspect during the war years. He was a refugee in a nation that was using its military might for noble rather than nationalistic goals. But the end of the war changed things. So did the dropping of the atom bombs. The increase in the destructive power of offensive weaponry led to a commensurate increase in the need to find a world structure for security. It was time for him to become politically outspoken again. For the remaining 10 years of his life, his passion for advocating a unified governing structure for the globe would rival that for finding a unified field theory that could govern all the forces of nature. Although distinct in most ways, both quests reflected his instincts for transcendent order. In addition, both would display Einstein's willingness to be a nonconformist, to be serenely secure in challenging prevailing attitudes. The month after the bombs were dropped, a group of scientists signed a statement urging that a Council of Nations be created to control atomic weaponry. Einstein responded with a letter to J. Robert Oppenheimer, who had so successfully led the scientific efforts at Los Alamos. He was pleased with the sentiments behind the statement, Einstein said, but he criticized the political recommendations as obviously inadequate because they retained sovereign nations as the ultimate powers. It is unthinkable that we can have peace without a real governmental organization to create and enforce law on individuals in their international relations. Oppenheimer politely pointed out that the statements you attributed to me are not mine. They had been written by another group of scientists. He did, nevertheless, challenge Einstein's argument for a full-fledged world government. The history of this nation up through the Civil War shows how difficult the establishment of a federal authority can be when there are profound differences in the values of the societies it attempts to integrate. Oppenheimer thus became the first of many post-war realists to disparage Einstein for being allegedly too idealistic. Of course, one could flip his argument by noting that the Civil War showed in gruesome terms the danger of not having a secure federal authority instead of state military sovereignty when there are differences of values among member states. What Einstein envisioned was a world government or authority that had a monopoly on military power. He called it a supranational entity rather than an international one, because it would exist above its member nations rather than as a mediator among sovereign nations. The United Nations, which was founded in October 1945, did not come close to meeting these criteria, Einstein felt. Over the next few months, Einstein fleshed out his proposals in a series of essays and interviews. The most important arose from an exchange of fan letters he had with Raymond Graham Swing, a commentator on ABC Radio. Einstein invited Swing to visit him in Princeton, and the result was an article by Einstein, as told to Swing, in the November 1945 issue of The Atlantic, called Atomic War or Peace. The three great powers, the United States, Britain, and Russia, should jointly establish the new world government, Einstein said in the article, and then invite other nations to join. Using a somewhat misleading phrase that was part of the popular debate of the time, he said that the secret of the bomb should be given to this new organization by Washington. The only truly effective way to control atomic arms, he believed, was by ceding the monopoly on military power to a world government. By then, in late 1945, the Cold War was underway. America and Britain had begun to clash with Russia for imposing communist regimes in Poland and other Eastern European areas occupied by the Red Army. For its part, Russia zealously sought a security perimeter and was neuralgic about any perceived attempt to interfere in its domestic affairs, which made its leaders resist surrendering any sovereignty to a world authority. So Einstein sought to make it clear that the world government he envisioned would not try to impose a Western-style liberal democracy everywhere. He advocated a world legislature that would be elected directly by the people of each member country, in secret ballot, rather than appointed by the nation's rulers. However, it should not be necessary to change the internal structure of the three great powers, he added as a reassurance to Russia. Membership in a supranational security system should not be based on any arbitrary democratic standards. One issue that Einstein could not resolve neatly was what right this world government would have to intervene in the internal affairs of nations. It must be able to interfere in countries where a minority is oppressing a majority, he said, citing Spain as an example. Yet that caused him contortions about whether this standard be applied to Russia. One must bear in mind that the people in Russia have not had a long tradition of political education, he rationalized. Changes to improve conditions in Russia had to be effected by a minority because there was no majority capable of doing so. Einstein's efforts to prevent future wars were motivated not only by his old pacifist instincts, but also, he admitted, by his guilty feelings about the role he had played in encouraging the atom bomb project. At a Manhattan dinner given by the Nobel Prize Committee in December, he noted that Alfred Nobel, the inventor of dynamite, had created the award to atone for having invented the most powerful explosives ever known up to his time. He was in a similar situation. Today, the physicists who participated in forging the most formidable and dangerous weapon of all times are harassed by an equal feeling of responsibility, not to say guilt, he said. These sentiments prompted Einstein in May 1946 to take on the most prominent public policy role in his career. He became chairman of the newly formed Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists, which was dedicated to nuclear arms control and world government. The unleashed power of the atom has changed everything, save our modes of thinking, Einstein wrote in a fundraising telegram that month, and thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. Léo Szilard served as the executive director and did most of the organizational work. But Einstein, who served until the end of 1948, gave speeches, chaired meetings, and took his role seriously. Our generation has brought into the world the most revolutionary force since prehistoric man's discovery of fire, he said. This basic power of the universe cannot be fitted into the outmoded concept of narrow nationalisms. The Truman administration proposed a variety of plans for the international control of atomic power, but none were able, internationally or not, to win the support of Moscow. As a result, the battle over the best approach quickly created a political divide. On one side were those who celebrated the success of America and Britain in winning the race to develop such weapons. They saw the bomb as a guarantor of the freedoms of the West, and they wanted to guard what they saw as the secret. On the other side were arms control advocates like Einstein. The secret of the atomic bomb is to America what the Maginot Line was to France before 1939. He told Newsweek. It gives us imaginary security, and in this respect it is a great danger. Einstein and his friends realized that the battle for public sentiment needed to be fought not only in Washington, but also in the realm of popular culture. This led to an amusing and historically illustrative tangle in 1946, pitting them against Louis B. Mayer and a coterie of earnest Hollywood movie makers. It began when a Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer scriptwriter named Sam Marks asked if he could come to Princeton to get Einstein's cooperation on a docudrama about the making of the bomb. Einstein sent back word that he had no desire to help. A few weeks later, Einstein got an anxious letter from an official with the Association of Manhattan Project Scientists saying that the movie seemed to be taking a very pro-military slant, celebrating the creation of the bomb and the security it gave to America. I know that you will not want to lend your name to a picture which misrepresents the military and political implications of the bomb, the letter said. I hope you will see fit to make the use of your name conditional on your personal approval of the script. The following week, Szilard came to see Einstein about the issue, and soon a bevy of peace-loving physicists was bombarding him with concerns. So Einstein read the script and agreed to join the campaign to stop the movie. The presentation of facts was so utterly misleading that I declined any cooperation or permission of the use of my name, he said. He also sent a spiky letter to the famed mogul that attacked the proposed movie, and also, for good measure, the tone of previous ones that Mayer had made. Although I am not much of a moviegoer, I do know from the tenor of earlier films that have come out of your studio that you will understand my reasons, he wrote. I find that the whole film is written too much from the point of view of the Army and the Army leader of the project, whose influence was not always in the direction which one would desire from the point of view of humanity. Mayer turned Einstein's letter over to the film's chief editor, who responded with a memo that Mayer sent back to Einstein. President Truman, it said, was most anxious to have the picture made, and had personally read and approved the script, an argument not likely to reassure Einstein. As American citizens, we are bound to respect the viewpoint of our government. That, too, was not the best argument to use on Einstein. There followed an even less persuasive argument. It must be realized that dramatic truth is just as compelling a requirement to us as veritable truth is to a scientist. The memo concluded by promising that the moral issues raised by the scientists would be given a proper airing through the character of a fictional young scientist played by an actor named Tom Drake. We selected among our young male players the one who best typifies earnestness and a spiritual quality, it said reassuringly. You need only recall his performance in The Green Years. Not surprisingly, this did not turn Einstein around. When Sam Marks, the scriptwriter, wrote beseechingly to him to change his mind and allow himself to be portrayed, Einstein replied curtly, I have explained my point of view in a letter to Mr. Lewis Mayer. Marks was persistent. When the picture is complete, he wrote back, the audience will feel in greater sympathy with the young scientist. And from later the same day, here is a new and revised script. The ending was not that hard to predict. The new script was more pleasing to the scientists, and they were not immune to the lure of being glorified on the big screen. Szilard sent Einstein a telegram saying, have received new script from MGM and am writing that I have no objection to the use of my name in it. Einstein relented. Agree with use of my name on basis of the new script, he scribbled in English on the back of the telegram. The only change he requested was in the scene of Szilard's 1939 visit to him on Long Island. The script said that he had not met Roosevelt before then, but he had. The Beginning or the End, which was the name of the movie, opened to good reviews in February 1947, a sober, intelligent account of the development and deployment of the atom bomb, Bosley Crowther declared in the New York Times, refreshingly free of propagandizing. Einstein was played by a character actor named Ludwig Stossel, who had a small part in Casablanca as a German Jew trying to get to America, and would later have a flicker of fame in Swiss colony wine commercials in the 1960s, in which he spoke the tagline, that little old winemaker, me. Einstein's efforts on behalf of arms control and his advocacy of world government of the late 1940s got him tagged as woolly-headed and naive. Woolly-headed he may have been, at least in appearance, but was it right to dismiss him as naive? Most Truman administration officials, even those working on behalf of arms control, thought so. William Golden was an example. An Atomic Energy Commission staffer who was preparing a report for Secretary of State George Marshall, he went to Princeton to consult with Einstein. Washington needed to try harder to enlist Moscow in an arms control plan, Einstein argued. Golden felt he was speaking with almost childlike hope for salvation and without appearing to have thought through the details of his solution. He reported back to Marshall, "It was surprising, though perhaps should not have been, that out of his métier of mathematics he seemed naive in the field of international politics. The man who popularized the concept of a fourth dimension could think in only two of them in considerations of world government." To the extent that Einstein was naive, it was not because he had a benign view of human nature. Having lived in Germany in the first half of the 20th century, there was little chance of that. When the famed photographer Philipp Hausmann, who had escaped the Nazis with Einstein's help, asked whether he thought there would ever be lasting peace, Einstein answered, "No. As long as there will be man, there will be war." At that moment, Hausmann clicked his shutter and captured Einstein's sadly knowing eyes for what became a famous portrait. Einstein's advocacy of an empowered world authority was based not on gooey sentiments, but on his hard-nosed assessment of human nature. "If the idea of world government is not realistic," he said in 1948, "then there is only one realistic view of our future: wholesale destruction of man by man." Like some of his scientific breakthroughs, Einstein's approach involved abandoning entrenched suppositions that others considered verities. National sovereignty and military autonomy had been an underpinning of the world order for centuries, just as absolute time and absolute space had been the underpinning of the cosmic order. To advocate transcending that approach was a radical idea, the product of a nonconformist thinker. But like many of Einstein's ideas that at first seemed so radical, it may have looked less so had it come to be accepted. The world federalism that Einstein, and indeed many sober and established political leaders, advocated during the early years of America's atomic monopoly, was not unthinkable. To the extent that he was naive, it was because he put forth his idea in a simple fashion and did not consider complex compromises. Physicists are not used to trimming or compromising their equations in order to get them accepted, which is why they do not make good politicians. At the end of the 1940s, when it was becoming clear to him that the effort to control nuclear weaponry would fail, Einstein was asked what the next war would look like. "I do not know how the Third World War will be fought," he answered, "but I can tell you what they will use in the fourth. Rocks." Russia. Those who wanted international control of the bomb had one big issue to confront: how to deal with Russia. A growing number of Americans, along with their elected leaders, came to view Moscow's communists as dangerously expansionist and deceitful. The Russians, for their part, did not seem all that eager for arms control or world governance either. They had deeply ingrained fears about their security, a desire for a bomb of their own, and leaders who recoiled at any hint of outside meddling in their nation's internal affairs. There was a typical nonconformity in Einstein's attitudes towards Russia. He did not swing as far as many others did toward glorifying the Russians when they became allies during the war, nor did he swing as far toward demonizing them when the Cold War began. But by the late 1940s, this put him increasingly outside mainstream American sentiments. He disliked communist authoritarianism, but he did not see it as an imminent danger to American liberty. The greater danger, he felt, was rising hysteria about the supposed Red Menace. When Norman Cousins, editor of the Saturday Review and the journalistic patron of America's internationalist intelligentsia, wrote a piece calling for international arms control, Einstein responded with a fan letter, but added a caveat: "What I object to in your article is that you not only failed to oppose the widespread hysterical fear in our country of Russian aggression, but actually encourage it," he said. "All of us should ask ourselves which of the two countries is objectively more justified in fearing the aggressive intentions of the other." As for the repression inside Russia, Einstein tended to offer only mild condemnations, diluted by excuses. "It is undeniable that a policy of severe coercion exists in the political sphere," he said in one talk. This may in part be due to the need to break the power of the former ruling class and to convert a politically inexperienced, culturally backward people into a nation well organized for productive work. I do not presume to pass judgment in these difficult matters. Einstein consequently became the target of critics who saw him as a Soviet sympathizer. Mississippi Congressman John Rankin said that Einstein's world government plan was simply carrying out the communist line. Speaking on the House floor, Rankin also denounced Einstein's science. Ever since he published his book on relativity to try to convince the world that light had weight, he has capitalized on his reputation as a scientist and has been engaged in communistic activities. Einstein continued his long-running exchanges on Russia with Sidney Hook, the social philosopher who had once been a communist and then become strongly anti-communist. These were not as exalted as his exchanges with Bohr on either side, but they got as intense. I am not blind to the serious weakness of the Russian system of government, Einstein replied to one of Hook's missives. But it has, on the other side, great merits, and it is difficult to decide whether it would have been possible for the Russians to survive by following softer methods. Hook took it upon himself to convince Einstein of the error of his ways, and sent him long and rather frequent letters, most of which Einstein ignored. On the occasions he did answer, Einstein generally agreed that Russia's oppression was wrong, but he tended to balance such judgments by adding that it was also somewhat understandable, as he juggled it in one 1950 response. I do not approve of the interference by the Soviet government in intellectual and artistic matters. Such interference seems to be objectionable, harmful, and even ridiculous. Regarding the centralization of political power and the limits of the freedom of action for the individual, I think that these restrictions should not exceed the limit demanded by security, stability, and the necessities resulting from a planned economy. An outsider is hardly able to judge the facts and possibilities. In any case, it cannot be doubted that the achievements of the Soviet regime are considerable in the fields of education, public health, social welfare, and economics, and that the people as a whole have greatly gained by these achievements. Despite these qualified excuses for some of Moscow's behavior, Einstein was not the Soviet supporter that some tried to paint him. He had always rejected invitations to Moscow and rebuffed attempts by friends on the left to embrace him as a comrade. He denounced Moscow's repeated use of the veto at the United Nations and its resistance to the idea of world government, and he became even more critical when the Soviets made it clear that they had no appetite for arms control. This was evident when an official group of Russian scientists attacked Einstein in a 1947 Moscow newspaper article, Dr. Einstein's Mistaken Notions. His vision for a world government, they declared, was a plot by capitalists. The proponents of a world superstate are asking us voluntarily to surrender independence for the sake of world government, which is nothing but a flamboyant signboard for the supremacy of capitalist monopolies, they wrote. They denounced Einstein for recommending a directly elected supranational parliament. He has gone so far as to declare that if the Soviet Union refuses to join this newfangled organization, other countries would have every right to go ahead without it. Einstein is supporting a political fad which plays into the hands of the sworn enemies of sincere international cooperation and enduring peace. Soviet sympathizers at the time were willing to follow almost any party line that Moscow dictated. Such conformity was not in Einstein's nature. When he disagreed with someone, he merrily said so. He was happy to take on the Russian scientists. Although he reiterated his support for democratic socialist ideals, he rebutted the Russians' faith in communist dogma. We should not make the mistake of blaming capitalism for all existing social and political evils, nor of assuming that the very establishment of socialism would be sufficient to cure the social and political ills of humanity, he wrote. Such thinking led to the fanatical intolerance that infected the Communist Party faithful, and it opened the way to tyranny. Despite his criticisms of untrammeled capitalism, what repelled him more, and had repelled him his entire life, was repression of free thought and individuality. Any government is evil if it carries within it the tendency to deteriorate into tyranny, he he warned the Russian scientists. The danger of such deterioration is more acute in a country in which the government has authority not only over the armed forces, but also over every channel of education and information, as well as over the existence of every single citizen. Just as his dispute with the Russian scientists was breaking, Einstein was working with Raymond Graham Swing to update the article in The Atlantic that they had done 2 years earlier. This time, Einstein attacked Russia's rulers. Their reasons for not supporting a world government, he said, quite obviously are pretexts. Their real fear was that their repressive communist command system might not survive in such an environment. The Russians may be partly right about the difficulty of retaining their present social structure in a supranational regime, though in time they may be brought to see that this is a far lesser loss than remaining isolated from a world of law. The West should proceed with creating a world government without Russia, he said. They would eventually come round, he thought. I believe that if this were done intelligently rather than in clumsy Truman style, Russia would cooperate once she realized that she was no longer able to prevent world government anyhow. From then on, Einstein seemed to take a perverse pride in disputing those who blamed the Russians for everything and those who blamed them for nothing. When a left-leaning pacifist he knew sent him a book he had written on arms control, expecting Einstein's endorsement, he got instead a rebuff. "You have presented the whole problem as an advocate of the Soviet point of view," Einstein wrote, "but you have kept silent about everything which is not favorable for the Soviets, and this is not little." Even his longtime pacifism